You're listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM.
Oh, honey, I just heard some terrible news.
What's that, honey?
The radio station WGXC is going off the air.
Oh, my goodness. Did you know you could donate by check? Give them a check to WGXC 5662 Route 23, Accra, New York, 12405.
And you can also go to their website, wavefarm.org or wgxc.org, and donate monthly, a sustaining supporter.
Oh, I'll be a sustaining supporter, honey, once we get up to that St. Charles Hotel.
Oh, yes, I love the bar there.
There's no bar there.
That's what I meant.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, featuring first-run and repertory films at movie theaters located in Rhinebeck and Saugerties, as well as live music, filmmaker conversations, staged readings, community events, variety shows, magic, comedy, and more. The Hudson Valley Picture Show traveling series brings cinema to locations around the region. The latest schedules, as well as upcoming pop-up events at the Community Theater in Catskill, can be found at upstatefilms.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Mary DePhillips in Hudson, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about creative...
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, once again, maybe for the first time, I don't know, you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. The name of the show on WGXC 90.7 FM, broadcasting from beautiful upstate New York, the counties of Greene and Columbia. The show Good Night, Norman. Tonight, more fiction, this time by Kurt Vonnegut. From his short story collection, Welcome to the Monkey House. I'm going to read the title story. Welcome to the Monkey House appeared a while ago. I think around 1950. Originally published as a hardcover by Random House in 1968. Here's the title story. Welcome to the Monkey House. So, Pete Crocker, sheriff of Barnstable County, which is the whole of Cape Cod, came into the Federal Ethical Suicide Parlor in the and he told the two but there, that Oh my God. Cry me a river. All right. Next story. You're listening to Goodnight Norman. The story is called Where I Live. Not very long ago, an encyclopedia salesman stopped by America's oldest library building, which is the lovely Sturgis Library in Barnstable Village on Cape Cod's North Shore. He pointed out to the easily alarmed librarian that the library's most recent general reference work was a 1938 Britannica, backstopped by a 1910 Americana. He said many important things that happened since 1938, naming, among others, penicillin and Hitler's invasion of Poland. He was advised to take his astonishment to some of the library's directors. He was given their names and addresses. There was a Cabot on the list, and a Lowell, and a Kittredge, and some others. The librarian told him that he had a chance of catching several directors all at once if he would go to the Barnstable Yacht Club. So he went down the narrow yacht club road, nearly broke his neck as he hit a series of terrific bumps put in the road to discourage speeders, to kill them if possible. He wanted a martini and wondered if a non-member could get service at the bar. He was appalled to discover that the club was nothing but a shack. 14 feet wide, 30 feet long, a touch of the Ozarks in Massachusetts. It contained an hilariously warped ping-pong table, a wire lost-and-found basket with sandy, fragrant contents, and an upright piano that had been under a leak in the roof for years. There wasn't any bar, any telephone, any electricity. There weren't any members there either. To cap it all, there wasn't a drop of water in the harbor. The tide, which can be as great as 14 feet, was utterly out, and the so-called yachts, antique wooden Rhodes 18s, beetle cats, and a couple of Boston whalers were resting on the bluish-brown glurp of the emptied harbor's floor. Clouds of gulls and terns were yelling about all that glitter and about all the good things in it they were finding to eat. A few more were out there, too, digging clams as fat as partridges from the rim of Sandy Neck, the 10-mile-long sand finger that separates the harbor from the ice-cold bay. And ducks and geese and herons and other waterfowl were out there too, teemingly, in the great salt marsh that bounds the harbor on the west. And near the harbor's narrow mouth, a yard from Marblehead with a 6-foot keel, a yawl from Marblehead with a 6-foot keel lay on her side, waiting for the water to come back in again. He should never have come to Barnstable Village, not with a keel like that. The salesman, very depressed and sensitive to the barbarous beauty all around him, went to lunch. since he was in the seat of the most booming county in New England, Barnstable County, and since the boom was a tourist boom, he had reason to expect something mildly voluptuous in the way of a place to eat. What he had to settle for, though, was a chromium stool at a formica counter in an aggressively uncute, uncolonial institution called the Barnstable News Store. Another Ozark's touch, an Ozark's department store. The motto of the place, if it's any good, we've got it. If it's no good, we've sold it. After lunch, he went trusty hunting again. Was told to try the village museum, which is in the old brick customs home. The building itself is a memorial to long-gone days when the harbor was used by fair-sized ships, before it filled up with all that bluish-brown glurp. There is no trustee there, and the exhibits were excruciatingly boring. The salesman found himself strangling on apathy, an affliction epidemic among casual visitors to Barnstable Village. He took the customary cure, which was to jump into his car and roar off toward the cocktail lounges, motor courts, bowling alleys, gift shops, and pizzerias of Hyannis, the commercial heart of Cape Cod. He there worked off his frustrations on a miniature golf course called Playland. At that time, that particular course had a pathetic, maddening feature typical of the random butchery of the Cape South Shore. The course was built on the lawn of what had once been an American Legion post, and right in the middle of the cunning little bridges and granulated cork fairways was a Sherman tank, set there in simpler and less enterprising days as a memorial to the veterans of World War II. The memorial has since been moved, but it is still on the south side, where it is bound to be engulfed by indignities again. The dignity of the tank would be a lot safer in Barnstable Village, but the village would never accept it. It has a policy of never accepting anything. As a happy consequence, it changes about as fast as the rules of chess. The biggest change in recent years has taken place at the polls. Until 6 years ago, the Democratic poll watchers and the Republican poll watchers were all Republicans. Now the Democratic poll watchers are Democrats. The consequences of this revolution have not been nearly as awful as expected so far. Another break with the past has to do with the treasury of the local amateur theatrical society, the Barnstable Comedy Club. The club had a treasurer who once a month for 30 years angrily refused to say what the balance was, for fear that the club would spend it foolishly. He resigned last year. The new treasurer announced a balance of $400 and some odd cents, and the membership blew it all on a new curtain the color of spoiled salmon. This ptomaine curtain, incidentally, made its debut during a production of the Caine Mutiny Court Martial, in which Captain Queeg did not nervously rattle steel balls in his hand. The balls were eliminated on the theory that they were suggestive. Another big change took place about 60 years ago. when it was discovered that tuna were good to eat. Barnesville fishermen used to call them horse mackerel and curse whenever they caught one. Still cursing, they would chop it up and throw it back into the bay as a warning to other horse mackerel. Out of courage or plain stupidity, the tuna did not go away. And now make possible a post-Labor Day festival called the Barnstable Tuna Derby. Sportsmen with reels as big as courthouse clocks come from all over the eastern seaboard for the event. Villagers are always mystified as to what brought them. Nobody ever catches anything. Another discovery that still lies in the future for the village and its villagers to make and to learn to live with is that mussels can be eaten without causing instant death. Barnstable Harbor is in places clogged with them. They are never disturbed. One reason for their being ignored, perhaps, is that the harbor abounds in two other delicacies far simpler to prepare, striped bass and clams. To get clams, one can scratch almost anywhere when the tide is out. To get bass, one follows the birds, looks for cone-shaped formations of them, cast his lure to the place where the cone points. Bass will be feeding there. As for what else the future holds, few Cape villages have much chance of coming through the present greedy, tasteless boom with their souls intact. H.L. Mencken once said something to the effect that nobody ever went broke overestimating the vulgarity of the American people, and fortunes now being made out of the vulgarization of the Cape truly bear this out. The soul of Barnstable Village just might survive. For one thing, it is not a hollow village with everything for rent, with half of the houses empty in the winter. Most of the people live there all year round. Most of them aren't old. Most of them work as carpenters, salesmen, masons, architects, teachers, writers, and what have you. It is a classless society, a sometimes affectionate and sentimental one. And these full houses, often riddled by termites and dry rot, but good, probably, for a few hundred years more, have been built chock-a-block along Main Street since the end of the Civil War. Developers find very little room in which to work. In which to work their pious depredations. There is a teeming, vast green meadow to the west, but this is salt marsh, the bluish brown glurp capped by a mat of salt hay. It was this natural hay, by the way, that tempted settlers down from Plymouth in 1639. The marsh, laced by deep creeks that can be explored by small boats, can never be built upon by anyone sane. It goes underwater at every moontide and is capable of supporting a man and his dog, and not much more. Speculators and developers got very excited for a while about the possibility of improving Sandy Neck, the long, slender barrier of spectacular dunes that bounds the harbor on the north. There are grotesque forests of dead trees out there, trees suffocated by sand, then unburied again. and the outer beach, for all practical purposes, infinite, puts the beach of Acapulco to shame. Surprisingly, too, fresh water can be had out there from quiet, shallow wells, but the local government, thank God, is buying up all of Sandy Neck but the tip at the harbor mouth, and is making it a public park to be kept unimproved forever. There is a tiny settlement on the tip of the neck, the tip that the government is not taking over. It is clustered around the abandoned lighthouse, a lighthouse that was once needed when there was water enough around to let big ships come and go. The bleached and tacky settlement can be reached only by boat or beach buggy. There's no electricity there, no telephone. It's a private resort, less than a mile from Barnstable Village. The tip of the neck is where many villagers go when they need a vacation. And all of the anachronistic, mildly xenophobic, charming queernesses of Barnstable Village might entitle it to the epithet Last Stronghold of the True Cape Codders, if it weren't for one thing. Hardly anyone in the village was born on Cape Cod. Just as petrified wood is formed by minerals slowly replacing organic materials, so has the present-day petrified Barnstable been formed by persons from Evanston and Louisville and Boston and Pittsburgh and God only knows where else, slowly replacing authentic rural Yankees. If the real Cape Codders could rise from their churchyard graves, cast aside their beautifully lettered slate headstones, and attend a meeting of the Barnstable Village Civic Association, they would approve of the proceedings. Every proposal that has ever come before the organization has been hotly debated and voted down, except that a new siren be bought for the rescue truck. The siren goes weep, weep, weep instead of rrrr and is guaranteed to be audible at a distance of 3 miles. The library, incidentally, now has a new Britannica and a new Americana, too. Purchases it made effortlessly since it has money coming out of its ears. But so far, the school marks of the children and the conversation of the adults have not conspicuously improved. Since the village exists for itself and not for passers-by, since it specializes in hastening tourists on to paradises elsewhere, visitors play hell finding anything to like about it. For a quick sample of how good it can be, a visitor might stop off at St. Mary's Church on Main Street, which has, unadvertised anywhere, the most enchanting church garden in America. The garden is the work of one man, Robert Nicholson, an Episcopalian minister, a good man who died young. As a village cocktail at a village cocktail party one time, and the villagers do drink a lot, Father Nicholson was talking to a Roman Catholic and a Jew, trying to find a word to describe the underlying spiritual unity of Barnstable. He found one. "We're Druids," he said. "Where I live by Kurt Vonnegut. I keep having technical difficulties, and it's really disturbing. Anyways, New dictionary. By Kurt Vonnegut. From Welcome to the Monkey House. I wonder now what Ernest Hemingway's dictionary looks like, since he got along so well with dinky words that everybody can spell and truly understand. Mr. Hotchner, was it? A frazzled wreck? My own is a tossed salad of instant coffee and tobacco crumbs and India paper, and anybody seeing it might fairly conclude that I ransack it hourly for a vocabulary like Arnold, J. Toynbee's. The truth is that I have broken its spine looking up the difference between principle and principle, and how to spell cashmere. It is a dear Leviathan left to me by my father, Webster's New International Dictionary of the English Language, based on the International Dictionary of 1890 and 1900. It doesn't have radar in it, or Werner von Braun, or sulfathiazole, but I know what they are. One time I actually took sulfathiazole. Now I have this enormous and beautiful new bomb from Random House. I don't mean bomb in a pejorative sense, or in any dictionary sense, for that matter. I mean that the book is heavy and pregnant, and makes you think. One of the things that make you think is that any gang of bright people with scads of money behind them can become appalling competitors in the American unabridged dictionary industry. They can make certain that they have all the words the other dictionaries have, then add words which have joined the language since the others were published, and then avoid mistakes that the others have caught particular hell for. Random House has thrown in a color atlas of the world. Concise dictionaries of French, Spanish, German, and Italian. And would you look at the price? Christmas is coming. When Mario Pei reviewed the savagely bopped third revised edition of the Merriam-Webster for the Times in 1961, he complained of the residual prudishness which still excluded certain four-letter words. Despite their copious appearance in numerous works of contemporary literature as well as on restroom walls, Random House has satisfied the complaint somewhat. They haven't included enough of the words to allow a Pakistani to decode Lack's Exit to Brooklyn or Ulysses either. But they have made brave beginnings, dealing wisely, I think, with the alimentary canal. I found only one abrupt verb for sexually congressing with a woman And we surely have Edward Albee to thank for its currency, though he gets no credit for it. The verb is hump, as in hump the hostess. If any emphasis on dirty words so early in this review seems childish, I can only reply that I, as a child, would never have started going through unabridged dictionaries if I hadn't suspected that there were dirty words hidden in there, where only grown-ups were supposed to find them. I always ended the searches feeling hot and stuffy inside, looking at the queer illustrations, at the trammel wheel, the arbalest, and the toupee. Of course, one dictionary is as good as another to most people, who use them for spellers and bet settlers and accessories to crossword puzzles and Scrabble games. But some people use them for more than that, or mean to. This was brought home to me only the other evening while I was supping with the novelist and short story writer Richard Yates and Professor Robert Scholes, the famous praiser of John Barth Skiles' Goat Boy. Yates asked Scholes anxiously, it seemed to me, which unabridged dictionary he should buy. He had not just received a gorgeous grant. He had just received a gorgeous grant for creative writing from the federal government. And the first thing he was going to buy was his entire language between hard covers. He was afraid that he might get a clunkier, a clunker, a word, by the way, not in this Random House job.